I'm with Nicholas Heitner, Artistic Director of the National Theatre, just as the NT is about to embark on an experiment called NT Live. Nick, would you like to explain what NT Live is and how it came about?
Great thing about the theatre is that it is live. It happens once, and by definition, only a limited number of people can get in every night. Doesn't matter how big your theatre is, there's always going to be a limit to the number of people who can see it. This is a way, we hope, of conveying the excitement of live theatre live to as many people as possible across the country and across the rest of the world. We're not trying to make a movie. What we're trying to do is use the skills of a very imaginative and highly experienced video team, multi-camera video team, to broadcast as vividly as possible the experience you might get if you were sitting in the theatre.
As it's happening,
we aim to be as creative and as imaginative as we can about the way we shoot it. But what we're going to be conveying is the excitement of the theatre into the cinema. We're not trying to make a wannabe movie, but we are wanting to use all the technology and all the artistry available to us to make it as exciting a cinematic experience as we can, but as a means to an end. We want those people in the cinema to feel something of what it feels like to be in the theatre. Now, there are going to be some big advantages. We're going to be able to take you in close, give you a closer view in the front row seat of a lot of what's going on. And in a play like Phèdre, which is fantastically emotional, violently passionate, the opportunity to be close to an actor like Helen Mirren is, I think, an opportunity that most people, even if they came to the Littleton Theatre here at the National, would not be able to have.
Yes, well, you're starting with Racine's Phèdre, but this pilot consists of four plays to begin with, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So what are the other ones?
After Phèdre, we're going to have Shakespeare's All's Well That Ends Well in a production that opened last night and has been phenomenally well received by the critics and is being really well received by audiences. It's a gorgeous, gothic, fairy tale, grown-up fairy tale production of an absolutely fascinating play. It's from Shakespeare's middle period where he was almost obsessed by the exploration of dysfunctional relationships on the stage. But the world of this production, which is a kind of almost Tim Burton world, is riveting. After that, we're going to be doing an adaptation of Terry Pratchett's newest novel, Nation, written for teenagers, but a show for everybody, a desert island story in a production which I think will be very inventive and very extravagant and very exciting.
That'll be in the autumn, will it?
That will be in the late autumn. And at the beginning of next year, we're going to be bringing Alan Bennett's new play, The Habit of Art, into cinemas. Absolutely cracking new play about W.H. Auden, Benjamin Britten, and The Habit of Art. It's about literature, music, theatre, and the difficulty of keeping going when inspiration disappears. And that has Michael Gambon, Francis de La Tour, and Alex Jennings in it.
Is it important to have actors who are known on screen for this experiment, or is that incidental? You've mentioned, obviously, Helen Mirren in the first play, and Michael Gambon and Alex Jennings are also well known.
It's extremely useful to us that the first of these plays has at the centre of it an actor like Helen Mirren, who is very, very well known to film audiences. But it will be interesting to see how many people want to see All's Well That Ends Well, which has an absolute top-flight National Theatre cast, none of whom have any particular film profile, but all of whom are superb Shakespeareans. That'll be really revealing. If there's an audience for Shakespeare, done extremely well, but without any eye-catching television stars, then we know we're onto a winner.
But you're beginning with Racine, a French classical tragedy, which is not an automatic choice for film. In fact, it's a very theatrical play in the best sense of the word. So is that an advantage, do you think, to be showing something which is pure theatre in this experiment to begin with?
There's very little physical action in Phèdre, but it is action-packed emotionally, psychologically. Huge amount happens to the people in it. It has no scenic spectacle in it. It's a play in which eight characters come into passionate conflict with each other and all change completely. It is what the French regard as their very greatest play. And I think what all of us regard as one of the two or three very greatest parts ever written for a woman. All the great European actresses have looked on Phaedre as the pinnacle of their careers. And I think Helen Mirren would say that Phaedre and Cleopatra are the two greatest parts she's ever played. Racine had one big subject, which was that love is a disease. In his plays, whenever anyone falls in love, they slide inexorably to disaster. It tears them apart. Their hearts explode into a million pieces. It doesn't end well. Phaedre has one of the greatest of all stories, which is the story of the woman who falls hopelessly and irreversibly and disastrously for entirely the wrong man. In this case, she falls for her stepson, for her young stepson, and she just can't shake it off. And the dramatic and emotional juice that this great playwright squeezes from that situation is really remarkable. In brief, she falls hopelessly for her young, highly attractive, athletic stepson. Couldn't be a worse person for her to be in love with, but we've all been there. She declares herself to him after she hears absolute, definite confirmation that her husband has been killed. The stepson is horrified, and then it emerges that her husband is alive, the great Greek hero Theseus, and on his way back. And in order to preempt her stepson's accusations against her, she accuses her stepson of rape, and it all unravels from there. It's a pretty good story.
Yes. Can you say why you started with Racine? How is it that Phaedra is the first thing you're doing for this experiment?
There was no particular plan to launch NT Live with a French neoclassical tragedy. We found ourselves able to launch this experiment this year. The technology's there, the will's there, the money's there. And here was a great play with a great stage actress who also happens to have a massive cinema profile. Yes. And Helen wanted to get behind it. So it felt like the ideal opportunity to get behind it. But you know, the good thing is that there is nothing more purely theatrical than French classical tragedy. It obeys the classical unities. There is nothing about it that makes any concession to cinematic naturalism. Probably we should have this conversation when we're talking about the play and about Racine. But if it works with Phaedre, it will work with anything.
Right. Okay. And you knew that this was going to happen before you had started doing more than casting. So before you'd started directing, you were directing with NT Live in mind, were you? And does it make any difference to the way you direct?
It makes absolutely no difference at all. And I will be encouraging all the actors, writers and directors who take part in NT Live not to think about the live broadcast. The whole point about this is that it should be as much as possible, and I think it will be completely possible, a way of transmitting the excitement of a live theatrical performance into cinemas. We're not trying to make movies. We're not trying to make television. The cameras are there, I hope, with a great deal of imagination and artistry, but they are there as outside broadcast cameras. Mm-hmm. They're there to transmit the live experience as much as they can. So it's not even at the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm. But this is a pilot, isn't it? So the four that you're doing,
yeah.
And then you'll see how it's going, and then it might happen again.
We want to see how many people want to come and see
yes.
it. We want to see whether we like the results.
Yeah.
We want to see whether it works. We obviously think it is going to work, but we want to see whether it works artistically, whether we are proud of what people are seeing in cinemas.
Yeah. Well, Racine goes so fast and at such an intensity. Is that something that's a bit of a problem for a director? It seems to be at a high level all the time, isn't it?
The problem is that it goes straight for extreme feeling. It's a kind of playwriting which is totally alien to the Anglo-Saxon sensibility.
Yeah.
Even more extremely than the Greek plays, Racine strips away everything except the essence. He wrote a lot about what he thought plays should be.
Mm.
And so did his...
And he was very interested in Aristotle, wasn't he?
He was extremely interested in Aristotle, and he was heavily involved with a French literary critic called Boileau, who the French will tell you is actually the dead hand of the French theatre. Yeah. But they were absolutely confident that the stage should not concern itself with what you might call the detritus of human behaviour. When Romeo and Juliet get together, it takes a party for which there have to be invitations. The invitations get sent out with a comedy servant. Comedy servant goes out in the street and has, if all you're interested in is Romeo and Juliet, apparently irrelevant scenes, distributing the invitations. The young men who are invited by accident get to the party. They have to fight their way through guests who don't want them to be there. An enormous amount happens before finally Romeo and Juliet catch their first sight of each other. The point of the play, of course, is that at the centre of it, there are star-crossed lovers. But you get at the star-crossed lovers through the world they live in and the people they associate with and the way they behave during the 95% of the time they're not staring into each other's eyes, being desperately in love. Now, the French classical dramatists, Racine, let's just say, never mind the others, Racine would simply not be interested in the 95% of the time. He's only interested in the extremity of the emotion. He's only interested in the 5% of the time when feeling is at its most intense. That's what the stage is for, in his view. He refines away, discards, if you like, the unpacking of the suitcase, the drinking of the glass of wine, the making of the breakfast, because for him, those are the things you can get in the street, at home. The stage is for the exploration of human emotion, human behaviour, human thought in extremis. He wouldn't see the point of all the rest of it. Now, that's really quite tricky for English actors. Because generally, what we do is we get at the extreme by playing something else. You unpack the suitcase and you play unpacking the suitcase. Meanwhile, your heart is breaking into a million pieces. What we love to do is to imply the breaking of the heart. In other words, we love to play the subtext, or rather, we love to play the text and allow the subtext to emerge. Now, you can do that with most every play. Funny enough, you can do it with the Greeks. You can play Greek plays over breakfast. You can have, if you want, just about Agamemnon and Iphigenia. You can have them meet in a warehouse, and you can have them play what it is to be in a warehouse. You can have them play everything except his need to sacrifice her in order to get the Greek fleet moving to Troy. You can do that. Most people don't do it that way, but you can do it. You can play the Greek plays obliquely. You can't play these plays obliquely at all. You have to go straight for it. You have to go straight down the line. And of course, he doesn't write simply about passion. He writes about passion as an affliction. That is his subject. During the bulk of his career, 10 plays long, his subject was the all-encompassing destructiveness of erotic and romantic passion. He knows it brings you down. He knows that it is destructive. No good will come of it. It's a disease. If you had to sum up Racine's oeuvre, you would say, love is a disease.
So when we have the gods, do we understand that the gods are really a kind of another way of talking about human feeling? Or do we put blame on the gods, as the Greeks would have? Are they manipulating? Are they guilty?
Well, plainly, this playwright sees them as a metaphor.
So Venus equals love?
Yeah, plainly he does, because he's even when he was brought up, not just a Roman Catholic, but a Jansenist, he rejected Jansenism, but remained a devout Catholic through the 15 or so years he was working in the theatre. Almost immediately he'd completed Phaedre, he returned to the Jansenist fold. Jansenism was a particularly extreme synthesis of Catholicism and Calvinism. It was not popular with the king. It was not popular with the court. It was not popular with the French establishment. It was not popular with the Jesuits, who had a kind of much more of a stranglehold on French Catholicism. So, yes, obviously for him, the gods are a metaphor in the way they're plainly not for the Greek tragedians. Again, you could qualify that by saying there is a case to be made for Euripides as being a sceptic as far as the gods are concerned. You stage the plays, you act in the plays, you are required to believe that these gods exist, because he is very concrete about the world, certainly about the interior world that he insists on his actors inhabiting. no use playing Phaedre unless you believe you're descended from the sun. Mm. So,
yes, the ancestry of the characters is extremely important, isn't it? And is it important for us to know, as a modern audience perhaps won't necessarily, any more than is revealed during the play about their background and about the society or milieu generally?
You don't need to know.
No.
You don't need to know anything more than what is revealed in the play. But, for instance, if you did happen to know that Phaedra's mother, Pasiphae, was inflicted by Neptune, Poseidon, with an uncontrollable lust for a white bull, for whom she developed such a passion that she persuaded Daedalus, the great Cretan craftsman, this is all myth, to build her a hollow cow so that she could climb into the cow and copulate with the bull, through which act of copulation emerged the Minotaur, Phaedra's half-brother, who was, of course, slaughtered by Theseus in the labyrinth, her now husband. If you know that Pasiphae represents for the ancient world unnatural lust, then you're going to get a little bit more from Hippolytus's constant insistence that Phaedra's ancestry is dodgy. But you don't need to know it. It's just nice if you do.
Well, he's obviously concerned about his relationship with his father and what his father stands for, isn't he? The hero, but also the philanderer, who he admires but does not wish to be like.
Yeah, he has a very acutely observed relationship with his father. It's a very acutely observed portrayal of the son of the great man. Great men often pass on poison chalices to their sons. And it's, again, useful to know, although much of this emerges during the play, that Hippolytus's mother was an Amazon. And therefore,
was she Hippolyta? Because sometimes she's described as Hippolyta and sometimes not.
In some versions of the myth, Hippolyta and Antiope are the same person.
Right. Takes us to Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, it's sort of. In some versions they're separate people. The Hippolyta in Midsummer Night's Dream is the future mother of Hippolytus. But the Theseus and Hippolyta of Midsummer Night's Dream are as remote.
Yes, they exist in another world.
From the Theseus of Phaedra as they are from Coronation Street. Yeah. But no, you get a very, very clear idea during the play that Theseus has rejected, by the way, possibly murdered Hippolytus's mother, who was a warrior queen, in order to marry the product of a lustful mother and a degenerate father. He has very acutely observed stepmother problems. He has very acutely observed problems with a father, half of whose behaviour he worships, half of whose behaviour he finds repellent. And he is himself, although not as extremely as in the Euripides, in the grip of a kind of pathological failure to acknowledge his erotic centre. So something's got to pop.
Yeah. Racine kept more closely to Seneca than to Euripides, didn't he? Or is that...
Well, structurally, yes. In Euripides, Phaedra is collateral damage. In Euripides, it's very plainly a tragedy about a young man who does not acknowledge Venus
and worships
Diana, Artemis, to excess, and so Venus punishes him, and Phaedra just has to get dumped by the by. And she disappears halfway through the play in the Euripides Hippolytus. Seneca brings Phaedra centre stage, but Racine's stroke of genius is that he invents a character, Arisi, who is not in any of the ancient texts, in order to give Hippolytus love interest.
Yes, some of the names are French, and some in Ted Hughes's version, some the Greek. Well,
I think there are two reasons. Partly, as you work on it, you realise that...
you don't want to keep saying Hippolyte.
you plainly don't want to say Hippolyte, and you plainly don't want to say Thésée, but then that's no reason for retaining the French names for Phaedre and Théramène and Ismène. It's partly a matter of metre, and as you work on it, you realise that it is metrically very carefully considered. But I also think that it places it in a hybrid mythic world of its own, and I think that's just fine.
Yes, it's a wonderful translation.
It's a brilliant translation.
If translation's quite the word. I mean, we've got Racine going back to the Greeks and Ted Hughes going back to Racine, who's going back to the Greek. So, and yet the Ted Hughes is also something very much of itself. Isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a brilliant translation.
Mm.
And it has a. It has.
Because some people say Racine is untranslatable.
Well, it's untranslatable. What's untranslatable is the Alexandrine. That is untranslatable. Yeah. Mm. You can. There is no English equivalent. Mm. I have read a translation, an English translation of Phaedre in English rhymed Alexandrines, and it's hideous. But English rhymed couplets don't work because essentially rhyme in English verse is an ironic satiric tool.
Yeah.
It's Shakespeare will provide a couplet at the end of a blank verse scene to round it off. But when he writes in rhymed couplets, he's striving either for comic effect or a degree of formality that unrhymed blank verse doesn't give him. Or he sometimes seems to be using it to suggest a degree of callowness or even insincerity. Rhymed couplets do not do in English what they do in French. French rhymes naturally without any particular
There's
effort.
There's something awful about it, anticipating a rhyme.
In English, awful, but in French, wonderful. In French, wonderful. If you hear great French actors doing this stuff, it has a wonderful inevitability. Two or three things worth saying about Racine's verse. First of all, at the opposite extreme from Shakespeare, he uses a vocabulary as small as possible because he wants the verse to be as inobtrusive as possible, and his policy, ruthlessly, is to exclude the striking image. His imagery is almost always conventional. What he's interested in is euphony. What he's interested in is a harmonious succession of vowel sounds, more than consonants. Ted Hughes is more interested in consonants.
Yeah.
English is more interested in consonants. English and German are interested in consonants to a degree that French isn't. So he's looking for a refined simplicity, but an extraordinarily elegant formal simplicity. Violent, passionate emotion, controlled by, intention with, a verse form which is formal, graceful, and extraordinarily simple. He obeys the rules of the Alexandrine Racine almost all of the time in a way that Shakespeare deliberately doesn't obey the rules of blank verse, partly because the rules of blank verse are made to be flexible, are made to have fun with. So, you know, Alexandrine, 12 syllables, always a caesura after the sixth syllable, he always does it. Always end stopped, he always does it.
Mm.
Always rhymed, he always does it. So for a French actor to be flexible with this stuff and not to fall into a chant of da 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 da, ce n'est plus une ardeur dans mes veines cachées, c'est Vénus tout entière à sa proie attachée. You can go to YouTube and you can hear Sarah Bernhardt do it, and she does it like that. That's how they did it until fairly recently. You now hear occasionally French actors do it with great suppleness and skill. It's much harder to do the Alexandrine like that than it is to do blank verse like that.
Mm.
Racine, total vocabulary 1,700 words. Shakespeare, total vocabulary 18,000 words.
Good.
Shakespeare invented 1,400 words.
Yes.
He invented, for the first time, almost as many words as Racine's total vocabulary in all of his plays. So you're dealing with a way of approaching verse which is at the opposite extreme from Shakespeare's. The premium in Shakespeare is on the striking image, the image that brings you up short, that makes you think, oh my God, that's such an extraordinary way of, just top of my head, the quality of mercy is not strained, it droppeth as a gentle rain from heaven. The imagistic complexity in just those two lines, never, Racine, never. It's not an ardour hidden. Actually, a famous couplet that I just quoted is famous because it's almost striking.
Mm.
This is not Nada hidden in my veins. It's Venus in her entirety attached to her prey. But even that is conventional. Venus attached to her prey, sure, why not? But the joy of it is in the sound of it. C'est Venus tout entière à sa proie attachée. Ted Hughes is striving for an equivalent simplicity. He said,
He said it was Racine, didn't he? When he said it was as simple as Racine.
Yeah, but it's a different form of simplicity.
Right, yeah.
It's accurate. It's not slavish. It's not aversion. He often goes his own way with three or four lines. He'll go for a concrete, visceral image. Instead of C'est Venus tout entière sa proie attachée, it's Venus had fastened onto me like a tiger. The tiger's not there in Racine, although Hippolytus is described as a tiger later on. He'll often go for a striking, visceral, physical image, and he will go for a kind of almost medieval, Middle English way with alliteration. But he wants it to be like a pane of glass. He wants there to be kind of no distance between the feeling and the audience. It's not verse that draws attention to itself. Or when it does, and he's very sparing with it, it hits you in the gut. And it's not, on the face of it, an obvious fit, Racine and Ted Hughes. No. But it's extraordinarily successful, partly because he makes no attempt.
It's one of the last things he did.
To do. There are some decent blank verse translations of Racine, but none of them are as good as this.
Well, you said that Racine makes very little concession to any idea of film. Not that he would have known about it, but I mean, it's very theatrical. But in particular, surely the Terrymen's long, long description of the death of Hippolytus. So it's, that's the sort of thing you would never expect to see on screen, isn't it?
No, well, it's theatrical in that everything is delivered.
Yes, but it's supposed, the need is for it to go into your imagination.
Yeah, it's everything is inverted. It's the actor and what the actor says. Yeah, a huge amount happens in this play, but there's relatively little physical action. Myth.
Tremendous reverses and changes of circumstance within these
people change all the time. There's a huge amount of action, but it's not physical.
Yeah.
When there is physical action, Phaedra grabs Hippolytus' sword. It's astonishing because the action is psychological, emotional. News is brought in from the outside, which sets everybody spinning. But film, which this is not,
opens out and shows
it
you.
It relies
as a rule,
a lot of it, not all of it, of course, a lot of it on physical action. And it certainly relies on naturalistic detail. It certainly relies on the creation of recognisable worlds. Everything in this play is delivered verbally. Well, that is purely theatrical. It's theatrical in the purest sense, not in the sense in which the world is word is sometimes used derogatorily. But yeah, you're right. Terramin's big narration, a film would take you out onto the rocky shore of Trozen, and out of the sea would come a monster. But I can guarantee you could spend $1 million a second on computer generating that monster, and it would not be as scary as it is as described by a man who's just seen it.
Yeah.